Hi, I'm Brianna Contreras, Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
Hello, I'm Peter Werwein. I'm Senior Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive.
Welcome to MHE Talks, Improving Patient Access, a new podcast series part of our Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast from Managed Healthcare Executive.
Patient access is a challenge that everyone in healthcare seems to have been talking about for decades. It's one of those big tent problems of American healthcare. A topic that takes in everything from practical problems like transportation to a doctor's appointment, or maybe in today's telehealth era, spotty Wi-Fi. There are also financial barriers to access, such as high out-of-pocket costs, and structural barriers, such as deeply rooted healthcare disparities and racism.
Our new podcast, MHE Talks, Improving Patient Access, will feature healthcare leaders and executives who are working to pull down the barriers to patient access. The goal is to have a lively, informative conversation about a foundational issue in American healthcare.
Well, hello, everybody. My name is Peter Werwein, and I am Senior Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. And for today's episode of Improving Patient Access, we're talking to Dr. Christopher Crow, who is CEO of Catalyst Health Network in Plano, Texas. So good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So I'm so happy that you're willing to talk to us and explore this topic that a lot of people are talking about these days, improving patient access. But before we dive into the subject matter, maybe you could sort of set the stage for us about Catalyst Health Network. I've seen it described as a clinically integrated network. I've seen it described as an ACO. Maybe it's all of the above. And just a little bit about how long it's been around and the number of physicians and number of patients that are seen by the physicians in the network.
Yeah, you bet. I'd be happy to give you the current stats, so to speak, on Catalyst Health Network. We are a URAC accredited clinically integrated network, and our business also has URAC accreditations for case management, transitions to care, and actually medication management as well. We are the only organization that we know of in the country that carries all of those distinctions. And we do that so that we can show that we have the pathways to clinically actually take care of these patients in an integrated way. We are a network of primary care physicians, as well as nurse practitioners and physician assistants that serve with those primary care physicians. They are all independent by nature. And our definition of independence is one that are either your traditional solo group proprietors that are owned themselves, or they could be owned by an entity, but that allows them to have a choice in how they take care of their patients and with their shared opportunities with decision-making with patients to get the best care. Meaning, yeah, they're not owned by a hospital system that tells them you have to use the hospital specialists in the hospitals and so forth, or some other construct like that, where your employer is directing care rather than you as the physician is. And we know about the differences, of course, across those in the country. Currently, we're about 1,000 PCPs across Texas, started in the North Texas region. And so that's where the bulk of us are, probably 750. We also have a little over 100 in East Texas, and around 100 just starting this year in Austin. All in, you know, that's a little over a million lives in the Texas region, 1.23. And then we also manage another 400,000 or 500,000 lives outside of that, some in Oklahoma. We use our platform without physicians to actually take care of employees. And then also for some insurance companies that have fully insured, unmanaged patients or members, as they call them, our model also takes care of that as well. So all in, we're well 1.6, 1.7 million lives that are potentially impacted by us on an annual basis.
And just to be clear, in terms of the public and the patient, you kind of operate in the background. If I went to one of your member physicians in Texas, would I know that he or she was a Catalyst Health network physician? Are you branded out there, or are you kind of in the background supporting the practice?
From a patient view to date, and that's changing actually right now, but heretofore, absolutely, you're correct, is we've been in the background. The way we think of it is, how can we, again, help that independent primary care physician not only survive, but thrive, and help them work to the top of the license, so to speak. So what we do is we help them on the business side, the revenue cycle, their IT, their EMR, their financial reporting, strategy, operations, workflows. How do we help them bring some scale and some professional work into those practices that then allows them to move their attention to the clinical side of things? And so if independent physicians spend an inordinate amount of time worried about their business and all the different things, and that's not what they were trained for. And so we help give them mindshare back to the clinical time or their lives. That's why we have some of the lowest burnout rates in our group, because we're giving them the opportunity to spend more time what they want to do in their trade or at their leisure. And then in their trade, in the clinical side, we build care teams for them, virtual care teams that work inside their EMR that are named, that are relationships that they have daily with their pharmacist and a care coordinator and a case manager, that doesn't matter who their patients are, whether they're Medicare, Medicare Advantage, or Blue Cross or United, help support them. So it's truly a leveraged team, an expanded care team that helps them with their patients. Their patients get to know them as well. They work inside the EMR, but they're more centrally located in the, whether that's in Oklahoma or whether that's in Texas, it's based off of the local population. And then we add some technology to that to actually augment those relationships as well, so the communications can happen and patients can be tracked and communicate with their care team in multimodal ways. And so that allows for the physician to practice at the top of the license. And so all of that is behind the scene. Our care team says, hey, I work for Dr. Crow. They are knowing more and more about Catalyst. Certainly everyone in the healthcare industry around Texas and now kind of nationwide is learning more about Catalyst, but we haven't put ourselves out there as a brand that patients understand yet, but that's a changing dynamic right now.
And maybe I misunderstood, but I thought there was also part of your business where you did maybe do some ACO contracting, or do I have the wrong end of the stick?
Yeah, you're right. So when I say that we're a URAC accredited clinically integrated network, yeah, the whole purpose is that is to be able to contract. So I guess I skipped over that as an assumption, but I'm glad you drew us back to that because it is something that we just kind of it's table stakes. Yeah, we bring the contracts to them. Just the way the NFL brings the TV contracts to the football teams, we bring the contracts at the commercial level, the Medicare Advantage level, and we only do value-based contracts. So we are only doing things that have an opportunity to show that we're providing a higher value of care and being rewarded for providing that value.
So are you a Medicare Shared Savings Program ACO?
No, we will be participating in the DCE program. The Medicare Shared Savings Program, this is around timing, and this is a great example of healthcare is local. When we started Catalyst in 2015, the Medicare Shared Savings Programs had been in existence for a year or two, and many of the doctors that joined Catalyst had joined MSSPs the year prior. So we chose at that time to not do that, to spend our time on commercial, where the bulk of people's patient panels were in, like 85%. So we said, let's just start where they have the most. And we'll get to that later. And as we've evolved, now it's time to kind of, as you go into the next versions, and quite frankly, we're really only, the next level interest of value-based care is to make sure that we're in prospective payment models, like we are only with Medicare Advantage, and the DCE provides that opportunity, which MSSP doesn't. And so we think it's a significant improvement upon current models, because it's starting to align a longitudinal payment model with a longitudinal care model. And we think that just makes more congruence.
Well, I may want to talk to you about DCE sometime separately. But okay. Let's, the topic of the day, this is sort of a long introduction, but sometimes you need a longer on, yeah. On is improving patient access. And when I was reading your bio, you started a patient-centered medical home, I think in 2007. And I believe it was NCQA recognized, maybe one of the first. So patient-centered medical homes had as their mission improving patient access. And just wanted to touch on the background, how you view the patient-centered medical home and whether it did begin to solve this problem.
Yeah, I think it was actually a really good first step. So if I take you back to a couple of years before patient-centered medical home, so I'm a family physician by training, grew up in a little small town that had three doctors in it. And they were doing population health. I mean, access was everywhere, right? They were on the city council, they were on the school board, they were head of the churches, they're on the sidelines. They couldn't go anywhere where they weren't accessible to take care of the population. So I grew up in an environment like that where that looked very normal. And so as I went through medical school and training, though, it started to be way more compartmentalized and very more assembly line. And I didn't understand that until you understand the payment model is fee for service. And then you understand that it is an assembly line. And it's not, it felt incongruent with what I was experiencing growing up as these physicians took care of us in our town. And so I just said, when I got out, I was going to make it. I didn't know what this meant yet at the time, but it was going to be different. And I did a lot of different rotations as medical students and residents that were more around business and looking at working with office managers and insurance companies to truly understand how this whole thing worked. And then I opened my own shingle, and I quickly went and got an executive MBA at University of Texas. And that really was an unlocking moment to me because it gave me jargon and concepts that I had felt in my soul for years. I just didn't have the words for it because I was a zoology major and went to medical school and didn't know what zoology was. And they didn't have those kind of terms when you're talking about medicine. But it made so much sense. It was like a veil got lifted and I could see clearly now. And so what that availed me to is to realize, hey, what's real, like at the core level, what's important to people in their healthcare? And number two and number three was access. They just wanted access to care. We made it so hard to get part of the semi line. And the second one that's next to it is convenience. They wanted access and convenience. And so we built a company that ultimately became Village Health Partners about 3 years, 2 or 3 years after that, where we built these medical villages where primary care was an anchor tenant. We still build them. We have a half a dozen of them. Specialists surrounded us. Services surrounded us that you would need, like lab and imaging and pharmacy. We integrated nutrition and counseling into the primary care office. All this is 2006 and seven. And it just made sense. And we said that our brand promise was going to be access. And every year we were going to try to provide more and more access, whether that be nights, weekends, online, other service lines, just access, access, access was our brand promise. When you called us, we were just going to say yes. No was not an option. Now, no, we may not be able to see Dr. Crow at 3 o'clock just like you want, but yes, we will see you.
Right, right.
Always right. The answer. Yes, we will see you. In fact, we had a rule in those first years when I was still running the group that you had to pull a fire alarm if you told a patient, no, we could not see you under any circumstances today. We almost pulled the fire alarm a couple of times. But access absolutely was the king. And when patient-centered medical home came around, and we were like, hey, we do all that. That's pretty interesting. And so we went and applied for it and got like 97% right off the bat. We were the first level three medical home in the whole United States outside of the coast where some of the academics helped build the model. We were on the forefront, which then attracted all of the insurance companies that wanted to do a patient-centered medical home deal. They had heard about it. And so we were one of the first ones around. And so, yeah, pretty quickly we had patient-centered medical home contracts with all the major payers, even though we were only 15 or so doctors at the time in a large metropolitan area full of thousands of doctors. And then we started performing. And access is a huge piece of that. If you are available there, especially in a PPO market where people can go anywhere they want for their care, like a big buffet and start at the end and eat all the dessert they want, which is bad for them. Whole nother topic you might want to talk about with me sometime. But from an access standpoint, access to primary care is really important. And if you can get at primary care, then you often don't need all that downstream, more cost. So
how did you've referenced sort of having a lot of services, sort of a one-stop shop, a notion popped into my head, but yep. How did you accomplish this access, this provision of access? weekend hours, doctors starting their day at 1 and working till 9 instead of 9 to 5. Give me just two or three things that made this access possible.
Use physician extenders, number one, nurse practitioners and physician assistants. You extend hours. You have online messaging available, and you do open scheduling, and right. Therefore the tradition in medicine is to make your appointment for 6 months later or 3 months later. We live in a world today where we do not know what we're going to be doing at 2 o'clock 3 months from now on a Thursday. And it is very hard to keep that appointment. And when we studied it, this gets back into the business brain of systems and strategy. And this is kind of where I started thinking differently now. It's like, how do you think about banking? You know, how did they go from tellers to all these smaller places to online? Just think about how do you think about travel and how that changed? And so I was using different industries to think about Starbucks. How do you do just-in-time customer service for what people need? And people need healthcare when they need healthcare, and they don't want to necessarily they can't schedule their acute visits ahead of time. When they want acute a visit, it needs to be seen then, not 3 days later, like our healthcare system sometimes does create. And if you do want to create a chronic disease visit for 3 months from now, you have like an 80% chance that you're going to have to call back and reschedule that, cancel that sometime close to that. And so that's just creating more work for all. So what if we just said, what if you could trust me, Peter, that I need to see you back in 3 months. I'm giving you, 3 months of medication or a month of medication. And you just call when it's convenient for you the day before or 2 days before, and you'll get seen. Now, you don't believe it until you start experiencing it. And then once you experience it, you can trust it. And so we had to build a culture first. The physicians had to buy into that culture. We had to have a philosophy amongst how we taught that to our employees and our teammates. And then you had a system that could show that you could actually do it and that you could continuously learn and modify your system based on where you're finding weak points. And so one of those weak points is, hey, we need more hours at night. Hey, we need more hours on the weekend. Hey, you get to a certain 80-ish% capacity, it's time for you to start adding more providers to your group.
Right, right. So let's fast forward to Catalyst. So as we discussed at the outset, you're operating in the background and in some sense supporting physicians. So in terms of this access ethos that you showed with the patient-centered medical home, how does that play out with Catalyst? Because is it up to the physicians that you partner with to sort of solve and deal with their access issues and you support their decisions? Or are you pushing them into this arena of greater access? And do they have to make some promise about access to become a Catalyst physician?
Yeah. Let's great question. So let's make a quick leap or a bridge from there to here where you are now is that those patient-centered medical home contracts we started to perform on. And so the community at large, the employers and the insurance companies started saying, hey, can you make Village Health Partners like 400 doctors across the Metroplex? Because it's cute that you have 15 doctors doing this cool thing. We're American Airlines, we're AT&T. We need people in 27 zip codes to get this, and you're in 4 zip codes. And so that was where we started dreaming about building Catalyst. And so now, yes, you fast forward to Catalyst, which is a member, not an employed model, really important to understand. So it gets to your question of what do we make them do? We're not trying to make them do anything. We're trying to support them and show them that we can actually, with our care team model, and the technology that supports that, we can expand your capacity, i.e. access, and we can help you even perform better on value-based contracts. Therefore, you're gonna get rewarded for expanding your access and capacity, and you're gonna get rewarded for the value that you create in lowering costs for the community. And the patients are gonna love you for it because they're actually gonna get more attention from you because a care team is an access point. So rather than thinking about 2 or 3 doctor's visits a year, you might have 30 access points a year with the care team. And if you add technology, it might be 300 access points throughout the year with these little devices that we have now in terms of integrating it.
If I'm reading you, if I'm understanding you correctly, you expect access, improved access, to be sort of a, some sense, a natural consequence of working with Catalyst. It's not something that Catalyst imposes on its members, it's not like you have a rule book that, dear Dr. Jones, you want to be a member of our network, you have to be open till 9 at night. You sort of see it as a natural outgrowth of the services you provide. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. If you're the only cook in the kitchen, your restaurant is going to be pretty small.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have a team of people in the kitchen doing different things, or you even have people outside the kitchen that are helping you in different ways. You can actually serve more people in a restaurant. And in fact, it can be even better food, and a better experience. Think of it that way, in terms of what we bring to them, is we're bringing them capacity, or we're bringing them care team, business services, and technology that allow them to expand their capacity, improve their access, see more people, and at the same time, show that there's more value to the patient themselves and to the payer, whoever that may be, the government, the employer, the insurance company, or sometimes even the patient itself.
Now, you're in Texas, which is a holdout against ACA Medicaid expansion. So I want to put you on the spot. Do you favor Medicaid expansion in Texas? And how does Medicaid expansion play into access, pro or con, in your state? Because many people think of sort of the floor of access, some degree of coverage. So where do you come down on this, and how do you see it playing out in terms of access in your state of Texas?
I think it's a crime that we haven't expanded Medicaid in Texas, and it's just a political football is all it is. And since Medicaid participants generally don't vote, you know, it's something that they don't influence enough the way the Medicare population does. So look, it's been proven in enough states now that the access actually improves the cost. The expanding Medicaid, Texas is a big state with a lot of uninsured people. So
it's astounding, the number. It's like a quarter of your population, I think, something like that.
Yeah, so let's be clear. Just if we expand Medicaid, we're not solving the whole problem, but it's something. And those people who would have access to care at least would have a chance to get some care to where later down the line, they're not costing as much. I mean, our lives are one big, you know, assembly line of ratcheting up potential physical ailments until we leave this earth, right? And so the more we can take care of it in the early years, the lessen it is in later years, or you prolong it longer. So it's a simple, this goes back to my business school. It's a simple, you know, supply chain, you know, economics of getting upstream of the problem and investing less dollars upstream so you don't have to worry about the big cost downstream. So what our legislature in Texas is effectively doing is creating a very big tax for the future, because these people can do nothing but get more expensive if we don't take care of them now. And expanding Medicaid, and people will say, just because you expand Medicaid does not mean they have access. And they are correct. But it means they have more access than they did yesterday. I completely agree with that argument. And I would say it still brings them a little bit more access than they had yesterday. And it does absolutely help them to get to think that they might be able to get care earlier. And that's a good thing. It does not solve everything. And some of the proponents or some of the opponents say, well, it doesn't solve everything. Nothing. There is no silver bullet. We have to come at it incrementally in this particular case and learn from it. So, and quite frankly, hey, Texas, as big as it is funding everybody else's Medicaid expansion. So, you know, we send our dollars to what do you think the federal government money comes from?
Yeah.
You know, funding everybody else's. And so, and now with Biden, it's 95%. So it makes no sense to me, other than it's so political now that you just, if you're on the right side, too far right, you just can't even consider it. You can't even think about it. Now, the moderate Republicans, they'll tell you all day it's the right thing to do.
Right. Right. Yeah, it has taken on, well, everything that we do these days has taken on a political cast. So you've been thinking and working on access issues for some, I don't want to date you, but for some time now. And a lot of what you say seems, referencing the patients in a medical home, in some sense, it seems like the more things change, the more they stay the same. But have you seen sort of an evolution of the access problems? Do you see them differently now? And have they taken on a different character? And if they have, how have the tactics or strategies had to change? Or are we sort of dealing with the same problems, really?
We are dealing with the same problems, but a couple of new things have entered the game. This has changed our concept of time. And so what 15 years ago, when I was building these villages that had, access and convenience at a single site in a neighborhood that had really good parking, that was awesome. But now people don't even want to go to the doctor. You don't want to go to the bank. You don't want to go to the restaurant. You want to just get it delivered to you. So everything is me-centered in our consumer world today. I mean, Amazon brings you everything you need at the door. I have 4 packages a day at the door. I mean, Christmas is not that fun anymore at our house because we open packages every day. It's not novel on December 25th. And so the expectations in healthcare has done a horrible job of keeping up with the technology and those type of expectations. We still have those crazy long lines and some of the same ways you do things. So in a way, the difference is consumer expectations have gone up, especially with the millennial generation. You know, the baby boomers are still, remember and go along with these old ways, but the millennials absolutely are not going to. We know that. Now they are getting chronic diseases, and so they're starting to appreciate the value of long-term primary care. I can tell you that. That's something that they maybe didn't think about 5 years ago that they are thinking about now, that maybe a PCP quarterback is a good idea. But what's where access is important is we have to get to the digital world. We have to be able to do everything for our health digitally. I completely agree. The bad thing that's happened, from all this advancement is it's actually fragmented and fractured care. If you look at primary care access now digitally, there are a kajillion apps, and Silicon Valley is putting trillions of dollars into it. And they're segmenting the population to, do you have this disease? Are you transgender? Do you have this race? Are you left-handed? Whatever. I mean, it's all these different segmentations of the population based on a characteristic of you rather than the whole you. Mm-hmm. And what primary care does is considers the whole you. And so what I worry about these apps is they're actually confusing people, because what if I'm a left-handed, Black, diabetic, transgender person and there's 7 apps for me that I could potentially...
Right.
And they're going to like that. That's actually confusing. And employers who are trying to actually help their employees are being bombarded by all these things that promise to save the world with access to something specific to them. And what we've made it so complex. But this is often the way the world works, is complexity often is a predecessor for simplicity. Because we've been simple, we're getting complex, we need to get simple again and say that, hey, access to integrated whole health primary care that does consider all the different things that you are at the time and the context of where you are, which changes year to year, is what we need to make sure you have long-term access to, because we know it has, even in the conditions that we've had in American healthcare for the last 40 years, it's still proven to extend life, lower costs, and have more good days than bad. If we can put it in the right financial model, if we can support it with a care team and appropriate technology, imagine what it could do for our country from a public health standpoint.
We're just about out of time here. So I wanted to just, before we bid you adieu, I wanted to touch base with you about something you've started called the Catalyst Community Foundation. And the little bit I've read about it, this is something that you think maybe can begin to address disparity issues. So could you just talk a little bit about the foundation and where what you're doing there?
Yeah, you bet. I'm super passionate about this and really see this being the next 25 years of my life in a very significant and even, you know, more significant way as the years go by. You mentioned Texas has 25% uninsured. I would add another 25% don't see a primary care physician every day. And I've quoted this, my little tagline, which now will be the third time, that primary care longitudinally with a relationship with a patient will help you live longer, cost less, and have more good days than bad. So why wouldn't we try to get that to the 50% that aren't seeing that in Texas today? And specifically in our region of North Texas, in the southern sector of Dallas and Fort Worth, you know, those are areas of healthcare deserts. There's no pharmacy, there's no physicians, there's few jobs, there's no grocery stores. And so how are you going to, if you believe you want to really help a community thrive, that means all. So how are you going to get care, primary care, upstream primary care to all? Because if we don't do that, like we said earlier, as you live your life, you're only going to get more and more expensive. And who's going to cover that right now? It's our taxpayers. It's us. So the whole thing about rising water lifts all boat, you know, lowering water does the same thing. And so we need to think of everyone. And so what we're doing with the Catalyst Community Foundation, so we have a 20-year vision, is that the children of today that are growing up where they do have clean water, which is great, not every generation has had that, and they do have free elementary school education, which is great, because not every generation has had that in the history of the world. And we know how important reading at third grade is to the rest of your life, you know, financially and your health and how that means to the community. We want to let those kids now that are enjoying elementary school and clean water, that, well, by the time they grow up and they have kids that are in those elementary schools, they also expect that they also have primary care, a relationship with primary care. They know that they're going to get at least taken care of from a basic health standpoint, that it's just a given. Mm-hmm. We think it's a right. This week, just 2 days ago or 3 days ago, the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine said that primary care is absolutely a common good and everyone in America should have one. Mm-hmm. Primary care for all has been our mantra for years. And I'm glad to hear this, that we're getting others to catch up. And so to date, some of the reasons those people don't have primary care is multitudes. But one, either they don't have jobs or, you know, they can't be covered by Medicaid. And if they could get one of those, they still might not get insurance, because for an employer, it's like $600-$700 per member per month just to get coverage, and that not covering your wife or spouse or children. So you still couldn't. So your choices are pretty around. You have to have all the insurance you need versus none. And so what we think with primary care being 5% of the whole healthcare spend right now, if you took 5, 7, 10% of that $700 and just said, hey, I'll give you primary care from a subscription standpoint, everyone has a cell phone. Almost everyone has a cell phone that they pay way more than $75 a month for, and everyone has a Netflix account. So somewhere in the middle, how do we find ways to catalyze everyone being able to get to virtual primary care? Now, virtual primary care that's comprehensive with a care team that I mentioned before, and how does it connect into the communities, those communities that have no health care? Well, what we've learned through COVID and what we've done with testing and now vaccination centers is we've partnered at Catalyst with churches, elementary schools, and community centers, because those areas are not church deserts. And the trusted relationships in those communities, and as a primary care physician, you understand the power of relationships. It's that relationship compounding over the years that allows for all the good things that primary care provides that I've mentioned three times. And so when you connect into these trusted relationships of churches, elementary schools, and community centers, and let those be the new centers of where you can, you know, you can have a trusted relationship to get healthcare to, and then those are your nodes to create a network, and you can virtualize that as well as have community health workers. And you can start to bring some, maybe a pharmacy back, and hopefully you start to have this 20-year vision to where we're not in it to be doing charity for 20 years. We're in it to actually show that there is a sustainable business model for people to healthcare professionals and those that live, connected to social services will help a community thrive, and that will be a 25-year goal to make it ultimately self-sustaining. And what's great about it in these churches and elementary school and community centers is you get to do multi-generational work. In all of those places, usually it's the child and the parent, or a parent and a grandparent, a child and an aunt, uncle, parent and a grand. So you get all this multi-generational working together as almost a requirement. And when you can put families together with care, then they have a built-in support system to ultimately help be with more accountable. So we're really excited. It's early. We have a long view on this. We're doing pilots starting this summer with a church, an elementary school, and a community center for about 50 to 100 people at each place to start to try to figure out and have a dedicated virtual care team with nurses and community health workers in the community at those access points to see what we can do. COVID has been a blessing because all of the school children in Texas, and I'm sure this is the case in other places, all got devices that they now have in their homes where they can log in. And so that creates what you and I have right now, is that I can get into every home again, and most of those homes are multi-generational.
Thanks for listening, and keep an eye out for the next episode of the MHE Talks Improving Patient Access podcast series. Episodes to this podcast can be found on our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.